Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Alaska has been an energy-producing state for decades, with oil and gas production long the dominant sources and the main driver of the state's finances. But the cost of energy for residents and business is high in our state, and the potential for cleaner, renewable fuel through wind, solar, hydro, and geothermal holds a lot of promise for the future of stable, affordable energy here. Funding that was made available through the Federal Inflation Reduction Act was driving plans and construction starts for solar, wind, and other projects across the state. But the bill signed by President Trump on July 4th rescinds a lot of funding and tax credits for renewable projects. What does it mean for Alaska? Renewable energy advocates join us to break it down today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello from Alaska Public Media. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. H.R. 1, dubbed by the president as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, is well over 900 pages long and endeavors to do a lot of things. We'll dive into more depth on other elements of the bill on Talk of Alaska in coming weeks, but for today, we're focusing on one aspect of the legislation, the changes to funding for renewable energy projects, programs, and data tracking related to energy efficiency. The changes are largely rescissions, cutting off funds and tax incentives for energy projects that may have already started but are now in limbo. Here to help us better understand what this means for Alaska projects is both the outgoing and incoming executive directors of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP, Chris Rose, outgoing, and Katie Lister, incoming. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here in studio. Also with us today is Natalie Kylie Bergen. Natalie is the energy lead for Alaska Public Interest Research Group, or AGPIRG. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Lori.
Thanks for being here. And on the phone is Bill Stamm. Bill is the CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, or AVEC. Welcome, Bill.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being with us as well. REAP, AGPIRG, AVEC, so many acronyms. Katie, it's your first day.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Before we discuss your ideas for REAP's future, tell us about your past work in assessing the economic viability of energy efficiency projects. What did that work contain, and what should people know about return on investment for renewable projects?
Well, I will say first, thank you for having us in the studio. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here on my very first day as the incoming executive director at REAP. I'm lucky to, you know, be able to have a couple of months with Chris before he transitions out. So hopefully this will be a smooth one. I have more than 20 years of experience working in the energy industry in Alaska, and have evaluated projects in all parts of the state, with a lot of focus for many years on renewable projects in rural Alaska, having administered the Rural Energy Fund when I was at the Alaska Energy Authority, and also overseeing the Power Cost Equalization Program. I mean, say, you know, in rural Alaska, I really have seen the benefits, immediate benefits of stabilizing and reducing costs of power for businesses and commercial buildings and also for households. I think that's the primary reason really why I took the job at REAP, why I applied for and accepted the position. I mean, I love Alaska. I grew up in Fairbanks. I have children here and grandchildren here, and really have a strong desire to see a more stable and sustainable future, kind of building this foundation to energy, just like roads and airports is sort of like part of the foundational infrastructure upon which communities build and do other things. And so I've seen renewable energy be able to sort of meet those goals. And so that is why I took the job, and kind of why I'm excited to get started at REAP.
Well, thank you. That was a great way to get us started here. And Chris, turning to you, you founded REAP about 21 years ago.
Yeah.
Tell us about that startup. Why and how you got started, and what was going on that you decided, I got to get something going here in Alaska.
Well, I was practicing law primarily in rural Alaska for about 13 years, and had seen a little bit about the energy situation there. That wasn't the only reason, but I had an aha moment about 23 years ago, actually, that everything that I cared about intersected on energy, whether that was the environment or foreign policy or the economy. Everything intersects on energy. And I thought, well, who is actually advocating for renewable energy and energy efficiency here in the state? And realize, as a lot of Alaskans realized, that that niche was open. And so there was an opportunity for me to start working with other stakeholders around the state and ask the hypothetical question, if I began a advocacy group for renewable energy and energy efficiency, would you join? And everybody said yes for the first 2 years when I was still practicing. And finally, we got together in June of 2004, and we started the group. And from just me, now we're at 15 folks doing work across the state. So it's been a great ride and a great opportunity for me to do something that I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, that's impressive growth, 15 folks now working on these projects across the state.
Yeah, well, we're not just working on policy. We're working on public education. I think one of the most important things we've been doing over the last 12 or 13 years is K-12 STEM education, teaching science and math through the lens of energy efficiency and renewable energy. And over the last 5 or 6 years, we've really pivoted a lot toward workforce training and capacity building, so that communities around the state that get technologies like renewable energy, wind, solar, and so on, are able to operate, maintain, and optimize those projects over time. So it's been a great growth in that area of workforce development and training.
And Natalie, how long have you been at AgPerg now? And talk a little bit about what you're doing in this energy lead role.
Certainly. So I've been at AgPerg almost 2 years, I guess, at this point. And I came into that role actually from being an environmental permitter working on infrastructure projects in the state, and now my first exposure to energy projects was supporting AVEC on renewable energy grants. And so that's really where I first got to see the opportunities and the impact that these sorts of projects can have in rural Alaska and statewide. At AgPerg, the focus is on the impact to consumers and the impact to ratepayers, and our energy costs are a huge problem. We have the second highest energy burden on average per household in the country, second only to Maine. AgPerg actually just worked with the University of Washington, Cook Inlet Keeper, and Native Movement. We have a new report on energy burden. So that's a real frame of how AgPerg approaches our work. And these projects and these programs can have a real financial impact on families' bottom line, household bottom line. In the current uncertainty of the new administration, we've been really focused on using our role as an advocacy group and the connections we have to some national entities that have more resources, that we've been able to put coalitions together to flag folks that are project recipients to DC, bring them into the room, be at the table with both our congressional delegation, but also agency staff, EPA, DOE, USDA. And so we've been fortunate to work also with the Arctic Energy Office to facilitate that. But our focus has been being a facilitator and supporting folks that want to advocate for their projects, articulate what these projects really mean. And when you're administering a grant and running a project like I have done, it's a really full-time, full-tilt experience. And so to need to be your own project advocate in this realm of uncertainty and keep on project deadlines is really a lot of work. And so we've been able to foster existing relationships and relationships I had from the practitioner side to be able to at least bring people into the conversation and help inform folks in DC that don't understand what a fly-in, barge-in, diesel-only community looks like in Alaska.
How is it that that Maine has more expensive power than Alaska? That I would just expect that Alaska, especially in rural communities, and especially in some communities that are, as you just mentioned, barging or flying in fuel, how can that expense be less than Maine?
one of the things that brings down statewide energy costs is low-cost hydro communities or places like Kodiak that have wind and hydro. And so renewable energy, statewide. Alaska does have the most census districts with severe energy burden and some of the highest severe energy burdens in that realm. So severe means you're paying more than 10% of your annual income towards energy. I would say there are niche spots across the country that are also microgrids. And Alaska's built this really robust system to manage microgrids. And a lot of these really phenomenal state-based programs, the Renewable Energy Fund and PCE, like Katie mentioned. And so we are making a lot of progress. And I think what's important to frame in this conversation is we were making progress and working on these issues before the Inflation Reduction Act was signed. Mm-hmm. And these projects already conceived of and in people have been wanting to implement them. And so we are facing some severe uncertainty right now, but we have great ideas and innovation that have been in the works and will continue to progress as we've innovated for the past few decades.
Bill, you've been at the helm of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, AVEC, for a few years now, taking over from Mira. What have you grown the footprint of AVEC at all? What should folks know that may not be familiar with the system that you have in place that is essentially a series of tiny little independent power systems, correct?
Yeah. So AVEC serves 58 member communities throughout rural Alaska. Only one of them is accessible by road. So these are remote, isolated microgrids. We get our primary source of fuel through burning diesel fuel, which is delivered typically in the summer months. The power plants have been integrated over the last 25 years or so with wind and solar, as we can afford to do so. That probably affects a little under half of the communities that we serve at this point. And the Inflation Reduction Act and Infrastructure Act was targeted a lot of funding that was looking at supporting underserved communities, tribal organizations, those sorts of things. And fortunately for AVEC, we ticked off a lot of the boxes and were very fortunate in partnering with other folks around the state and getting a tremendous number of projects approved for funding. And we were looking at rolling out probably more than a dozen new projects over the next 3 or 4 years and putting in large solar arrays and energy storage that would help displace quite a bit of diesel, repowering wind sites with larger wind turbines, those sorts of things. And a lot of that is still a little bit in flux. Certainly since the new administration came on, there were a couple of hurdles thrown down early as far as putting a stop on any of the projects that were in progress until there was the reevaluation. And there was certainly a reduction at the Department of Energy in manpower. So finding the right people to talk to and even having information about what projects were going to be able to move forward took some time. And now with this recent passage of HR 1, there's a lot more clarity. Unfortunately, there's a reduction specifically targeted at wind and solar, which is really the sole resource, local resource for many of AVEC communities. We don't have hydro facilities or availability of hydro facilities. So the impact of wind and solar projects is probably magnified in the existing legislation.
All right. Thank you for that, Bill. Just to let folks know, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the prospects for Alaska's renewable energy future today and trying to seek some clarity on what's going to happen with projects that may be underway now or we're planning to get started now that the reconciliation bill has been signed into law. And within that bill, there are clawbacks for funding for renewable projects. In the studio with me today is Chris Rose. Chris is the outgoing founder and executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP. Katie Lister is the incoming executive director for REAP and is also in the studio with us today. Katie's first day is today. Natalie Kylie Bergen is the energy lead for AGPERG, Alaska Public Interest Research Group. And on the line with us is Bill Stamm, who is the CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, or AVEC. Before we talk about the reconciliation bill the president signed on the 4th of July, let's talk a bit about some previous legislation. First, the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. The EPA page on that act calls it the most significant climate legislation in U.S. history, with an aim to reduce renewable energy costs for organizations like Green Power Partners, businesses, schools, nonprofits, state, local, tribal orgs. The act went into effect on January 1st of 2023. Describe what that law set out to do for renewable energy production. Just sort of, if you can, give us kind of an overview of the main incentives and amounts of funding that were within that. And then I want to talk about some other acts that go back even farther that you were referencing, I think, Natalie.
Well, the thing that I think really helped the renewable energy industry the most out of the Inflation Reduction Act is the certainty that was brought by extending the tax credits for 10 years. We'd had tax credits for renewable energy extended by Congress 2-3 years at a time for years. But that did not give the industry the time to ramp up for manufacturing facilities to be built, for people to realize, hey, this is something we can count on for the next decade. We're going to invest. And we saw huge investments after the Inflation Reduction Act was passed. In fact, the last several years in a row, 80 to 85% of all new additions of electricity in the United States have been wind and solar and batteries. And that's because it's the fastest growing and cheapest electricity on the planet, particularly with the tax credit. So as Bill said, the target in this latest bill has been wind and solar. And that's really going to change the way that the industry sees its ability to invest. It's going to crush all the projects that are in the pipeline down into a very narrow bit of time that we have to get them built in order to get the tax credits, because they all have to start construction, essentially spend about 5% of the construction costs in the next 12 months. That's going to make prices go up, and it's going to make it harder for a lot of projects to get built. And I think for Alaska, it's also going to mean, and particularly in rural Alaska, a triage where not all the projects that were in the pipeline are going to be able to get built in that short period of time. On EPA, as you mentioned, one of the biggest things with the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, $27 billion, and that was included. That included $7 billion for solar for all, and Alaska got, I think, about $125 million of that money. That so far is not in jeopardy, but we've been hearing even some rumors that EPA lost some of the funding that they had to administer the entire Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. So perhaps they need to find funding to at least administer solar for all. But the $20 billion that was going to green banks around the country is in jeopardy, and some of that's held up in litigation. And of course, we have a new green bank in the state of Alaska that was hoping to get some of that federal money, so that will also be impacted.
The mandate within the reconciliation bill that says projects have to be done in a year, does that mean they have to be completely up and running in a year?
Start construction.
Or they've got did you say 5% has to be spent in that first year?
Yeah.
So it is possible that people could get going, get stuff started in this next year, but
absolutely
still have a longer timeline. So that seems good.
And in the rail belt, where we've had the co-ops considering projects for some time, they now have a deadline. So the co-op boards of directors have a deadline in the next 12 months to make a decision on some of the projects that have been offered to them and sign a power purchase agreement so that the developer can spend that 5% before July of 2026.
The Inflation Reduction Act, as we've referenced, was certainly not the first legislation that sought to incentivize renewable energy. The Energy Policy Act was signed by President George Bush in 2005, 20 years ago, and the Energy Independence and Security Act was in 2007, also signed by Bush. Both endeavored to move the U.S. toward greater energy independence and security, increase production of clean renewable fuels, increase efficiency of buildings and vehicles, among other efforts. How much did these laws, created two decades ago, move the needle in our country toward more renewables? Katie, you want to take a shot at that?
I don't have a specific answer about how much those moved the needle, but I think it's worth noting that renewable energy is not new, right? Like, some of the very first power generation systems built in the state were renewable systems that were built by the mining industry and the fishing industry. all of these technologies that we're talking about, hydro, wind, solar, these are tried and true and have been integrated in Alaska and throughout the United States and the world for many, many years. I will say that I think I just maybe going back for a second, I did want to note just the specific kind of call out of wind and solar and its impact on Alaska. I mean, Natalie mentioned energy cost burden and how lower down in the state, in the southern part of the state, there are a lot of communities where there has been prior state government investment in large hydro systems, which has really lowered the cost of power, including on the rail belt where we have Bradley as a state investment that helps lower and control our energy costs. And it really is the sort of most, the harshest climates and the sort of smallest, most remote communities in the northern parts of the state where there are not those other resources. There's not a hydro resource that is economically viable. There's not necessarily a geothermal resource. The only local renewable resources in those communities are wind and solar. And so the impact of this bill is really taking options off the table for Alaskans. And I think that, you know, we hear people say it all the time, or the congressional delegation says it all the time, we need all of the tools in our tool belt in Alaska. We need to be able to use everything, all of the options that we have to address our energy needs. I think the only other thing I wanted to just maybe mention really quick about the Inflation Reduction Act specifically is just the timing of this funding being infused and the sort of the extension of those tax credits for a timeline that, you know, investors felt gave them some certainty was really important, kind of and synergistic with the increase in energy demand in our country. I mean, looking at AI and server farms, like big new industrial loads. And Alaska is a little bit behind this trend, but the rest of the country is certainly moving toward the electrification of everything with heat pumps and electric vehicles and more large electric appliances in our homes. So as a country, and we need more energy now. And what this most recent bill does is really sort of take some of the options off the table. And for rural communities, particularly rural in Alaska, it really takes some of the only renewable options off the table.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones for a moment. John is in Fairbanks. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for having your guests on. Interesting program. I wanted to ask the question. Oftentimes people say, well, renewable energy is great, but it doesn't help us much in the wintertime when the sun doesn't shine. Can you guys comment on that?
So you're looking for information on the efficiency of solar and also wind, it looks like, from your comments.
And wind, right.
Well, we have more wind typically across Alaska in the winter. That complements the fact that we have more sun in the summer. In the rail belt, for instance, we've had this discussion quite a bit about how solar can help us displace natural gas that we would ordinarily burn in the summer and store it. We're in a gas crisis in Cook Inlet. We're in a gas crisis in South Central Alaska. Anything we can do to displace natural gas here or displace diesel in rural communities allows that fossil energy to be stored. And so it's an all of the above approach. And wind and solar actually complement each other very well in most parts of the state right now.
All right, John.
Yeah. If I could follow up on that.
Please
I guess
Bill.
Some folks think that solar is only a summertime phenomena, but we do have a few communities that have already been built out with, large solar arrays and energy storage that are integrated to the point where we can actually go diesels off when the sun is shining. And it's been a little bit of a learning experience and a further effort on AVEC's part to figure out how much we can capitalize on that infrastructure investment, because we were getting enough solar early in the year, February, March timeframe, above the Arctic Circle, where the temperatures are still below freezing, sometimes 20 or 30 below, and we have enough solar to go diesels off. But we're not able to do that because we don't have the infrastructure to keep our diesel plant warm. And we're working through the logistics and further implementation of that. But there's tremendous resources locally available if we could just build the right equipment to take advantage of it.
Bill, you were quoted in a New York Times story in May about a solar project in Noatak. Is consistency in approach a big part of the problem that's happening right now? One administration leans into renewables. We were talking about some of these past acts. The next administration comes in and may want more fossil fuel production. Many projects are multi-year undertakings, as we know. So does this lack of consistency create a chilling effect for local governments and communities that may want to move to cleaner fuel but are wary of starting something that they might be on the hook for?
Yeah, short answer is yes. I mean, there certainly seems like there is a bit of a whiplash going on presently. As Chris had pointed out, you know, the 10-year lookout for tax incentives gives people something that they can shoulder into and say, we're going to develop this over a longer term. You can attract other funds to help bolster whatever grant funding you have. Typically, there are matching funds required, and you might be able to entice regional native corporations that have a tax appetite to pitch in additional funding to make these projects go forward. So yes, having a back and forth is definitely difficult. Fortunately or unfortunately, there are so many unmet needs in rural communities. I think about the dearth of funding that was available for diesel power plant only upgrades or bulk fuel farm maintenance and repair upgrades, because over the last 4 or 5 years, there's been tremendous focus on renewables, which is great and has been a huge benefit, but to the detraction of other traditional legacy plants that still need work. Maybe we are taking a step in a different direction, but there's still a lot of unmet need there.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Natalie, you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, follow up to some of what Bill's talking about. These projects are built on financing stacks. So the federal government is providing some pretty big, substantial investments, but these projects don't happen in isolation with just that one source of funding. Matching funds, such as Bill mentioned, other local investments. And so when you affect one piece of a stack of funding, that's been years of putting all of those resources together, and the kind of momentum moves in one direction or the other. And absolutely making sure that there's not just financing for one piece, like installing a wind turbine, but also power plant upgrades, fuel farm upgrades, being able to have workforce development. And what's been really powerful about the way these programs were set up and all the opportunities that are to different extents in limbo is that they complemented each other really well, whether it's multiple sources of financing, but also multiple types of projects that can really integrate into a full community and have both the workforce and the power plant and the generation system that you need to be able to make use and benefit residents directly.
That's such an important point, too, that it's not just one single project. It oftentimes is multiple layers of projects that also need multiple layers of different types of funding to put it all together. All right, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the future of renewable energy in Alaska and what the reconciliation bill may mean for momentum on some of those projects as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the future of renewable energy in our state with the outgoing and incoming executive directors for Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP. Chris Rose is in the studio with us today. Chris is the outgoing founder and executive director of REAP, and Katie Lister is the incoming executive director, who started today in her new job. Also in the studio is Natalie Kylie Bergen, the energy lead for ACPERG, that is the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. And on the phone is Bill Stamm, who is the CEO of AVEC, which is the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Kevin says, I am installing a solar electric system at my home this summer. Will there be a federal tax credit for tax year 2025?
Yes.
All right. Yes. You are a winner, Ken. Your project is going to have that. We talked a little bit about some of this, but here's kind of a specific question about other funding. Daniel asks, with federal funding for renewable alternative energy in question right now, What are some other funding venues that your organizations have considered to keep these types of projects moving forward? Are there some foundations and others? I know that sometimes it requires community matches, and so local governments have to pony up some money, but are there other places to go beyond the federal government?
Well, the idea of a green bank is that a bank shows the commercial banks how to lend on things like clean energy. 100 years ago, you could not get a car loan. Banks had no idea what cars were, what the risk management for that was. And over time, they understood what a car was, and now you can get a car loan for 0% interest, a thing that depreciates immediately when you drive it off the lot. And yet when you go to a bank today in Anchorage and you ask for a loan to put solar on your house or to do energy retrofits to make your house more efficient, you're typically going to get an offer of a 10% loan with a 5-year payback. So the whole idea of a green bank is that it leads the other banks in the sector toward understanding how to manage the risk of these projects. And on energy efficiency, there is not a ton of risk. And so I think a lot of us are going to have to be pivoting toward more different kinds of financing where you actually get a lower interest rate, but you have more time to pay it back. So your energy savings actually equal or even exceed your monthly payment. That's one direction that we can go. And the new state green bank, which is called the Alaska Sustainable Energy Corporation, is just getting going. It's under the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, AHFC. It has language in the bill that authorized it to focus on energy efficiency and renewable energy for residential, commercial, and community buildings. And so we're really hoping that a lot of that effort can take place. Besides that, we have the state's Renewable Energy Fund, which started back in 2008. If the state can put more money into that, that can certainly help, especially in communities with a high energy burden in rural Alaska.
Was the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation relying on federal funding for a lot of what they're endeavoring to do now with the Green Bank and other programs, or do they have enough funding from their existing programs to get things off the ground regardless of federal funds?
I think they were certainly hoping for some of that $20 billion that is in litigation now from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. But again, these are loans. And so the state should be able to come up with a revolving loan fund to do this kind of work. This is not grant money. And we do have money here in the state if we can repurpose it in the right directions.
For all of you, do you see the move to renewable energy as an imperative for more reliability through redundant systems, layers of different energy sources, cost stability for consumers and businesses, or is it more about addressing climate change, or is it just all of the above? Katie?
I would say that it is all of the above, but the real kind of the what resonates most and what is sort of most directly and immediately felt, I think in Alaska, is affordability and stability. I mean, we've talked about, you know, the benefits of the certainty of tax incentives. There are benefits at a household level of knowing what your utilities bills are going to be from year to year. So just providing that stability and providing an affordable source of energy. It also has economic benefits in that it keeps money in communities. You know, for every time we burn 10,000 gallons of diesel in a rural community, all of that money is going directly out. If we can keep more of those dollars in communities, then they potentially have a multiplier effect and build more resilient economies. Renewable energy, I mean, stable priced energy also has the potential to attract industry. I mean, I think we're seeing that all over the world with, communities and countries that are making investments to stabilize and their cost of power and bring down their cost of power so that they can attract all of this new industry, particularly related to AI and server farms.
Mm-hmm.
I would just add this issue of price stability. Natural gas and diesel are tied to global market prices. You invest in that infrastructure, you don't know over the lifespan of that infrastructure what it's going to cost. You invest in wind, solar, renewables. There's an upfront investment in the physical infrastructure, but there's no cost for the energy source coming in and being used over time. And so the long term, as consumer advocates at ACPRG, we see the long term price stability paying back multifold for consumers and residents. And you can see that with the Renewable Energy Fund, there's been a 2-to-1 return on investment for the money that's state money that's been put towards feasibility, design, even construction of various projects has gotten the ball rolling. And there's been a 2-on-1 investment in the community and the economy for every dollar spent on these projects.
Such an important point, the stability aspect of renewable energy. Once the infrastructure is in place, it's not subject to the whims of wars in other countries that can disrupt the fossil fuel supply. So there is that stability aspect to it that is an important point. Bill, as we talked about earlier, prior legislation, incentives going back well more than a couple decades to incentivize renewable energy. You were talking about AVEC's current system for energy, but what is the percentage, if you have an idea of that, how much is still diesel? And have you been able to leverage quite a bit of federal funding to help bring on renewables?
Yeah, well, I guess on the big picture with all of our communities, unfortunately, the ratio does not sound very good. We're still close to 90-95% diesel if you look at all of our communities. But we've got 32 wind turbines in 14 different locations that help supply power in 20 different communities, but it's only operating in those communities. And, you know, we can displace typically around 20-25% of diesel fuel in communities with wind. Some of our newer systems with larger turbines and energy storage, we're getting closer to 50% diesel displacement. And for AVEC, the cost of diesel fuel just to get diesel to our communities is more than half the cost of electricity for anybody that's buying power off the AVEC system. So it's always been a imperative to try to displace as much diesel as we can. And wind and solar are local energy sources that can be developed to do just that. The benefit of the new technology is something that we would like to expand and put into many more communities. I think solar works just about everywhere in Alaska and could be the systems that we've started to install could be replicated everywhere. Wind is also another resource dependent. Not everybody has enough wind to make a wind system viable in these small communities. But looking forward, we're still anxious to build more renewable projects and bring as much diesel cost to our communities down that we can.
Thank you, Bill. The EPA states that starting on January 1st of 2025, the Inflation Reduction Act replaces the traditional production tax credit with the clean energy production tax credit and the traditional investment tax credit with the clean electricity investment tax credit. Did traditional in this sense mean it was a tax incentive primarily aimed at oil and gas industry? Is that something that...
I don't think I can answer that question.
Okay, that's
fine. I haven't really studied that difference yet.
I wondered if that's what it meant and what the fate of it may be now with the reconciliation bill signed. I guess that's one of those unknowns that we'll have to study and watch.
I mean, the big takeaway that we've been talking about is the tax credits for wind and solar are going to go away and that there is a very rapid timeline for that to happen. And so we just need to move very quickly.
People have to get projects going this year. And is it 5% have to spend?
That's one of the tests that people typically use, a safe harbor, 5% of the construction costs.
Okay. Governor Dunleavy at one point was really touting carbon capture and sequestration as a potential big moneymaker. He suggested forestry set-asides that could rake in millions of dollars for carbon offsets. And said Alaska could consider taking CO2 from other countries and sequestrate an empty Cook Inlet oil reservoirs. What do you all think about those plans? Are they realistic and should the state pursue those?
I mean, I think it's something that is worth exploring. And there are a lot of people who are right now doing just that. I will say that the companies that were sort of most sort of active in Alaska in looking at importing carbon and doing carbon sequestration in the Cook Inlet were relying on these tax incentives. and they were relying on offshore wind and the tax incentives. It seems significantly less likely that that will be a viable business opportunity, but I'm not them, so certainly wouldn't want to speak for them. I think that carbon sequestration is an interesting idea. There certainly are folks who have in Alaska who have participated in the in carbon markets, forestry folks who have participated in carbon markets and tribes throughout the state, mostly in the interior and in southeast. It seems like it is helpful, but hasn't yet been sort of a panacea or like a large amount of money. But it has been helpful to kind of put certain projects over the edge to make them economic and make them viable.
ACPERG, our response would be, like, there are certainly people working on it and looking into it, and we're more focused on what can make a difference in folks' expenses and in their immediate energy costs. And so the direct impact is harder to see and a little bit less clear, and we have these proven technologies that can make that impact. I also think as consumer advocates and public interest, we want to make sure that safety is a top priority. Transporting carbon in gas form and liquid, like, there are some concerns and priorities that we want to make sure are well thought out before tankers are in Cook Inlet, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the future of renewable energy in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are talking about the future of renewable energy here, and I just wanted to read a little something. This isn't a question, but it's a great enthusiastic comment from Gary, is it Hennig?
Mm-hmm.
Of the city of King Cove. He's the city administrator. He says he's been the city administrator for the last 30 years, and renewable energy has been one of his proudest accomplishments during that time. He wrote to us about King Cove being 90% on hydro energy now. And also in part of this message, he says, our two hydro facilities have saved or avoided more than 4 million gallons of diesel fuel and saved 6 million in costs, and has also saved the PCE, the Power Cost Equalization Program, more than $2 million in payments. He writes, even with King Cove's PCE disincentive, our hydro facilities have been saving our residential households $750 annually. Wow, that's an impressive amount of saving. We are going to go back to the phones and talk with Bill in Juneau. Hello, Bill.
Hello, are you there?
Yes, we are, as are you.
Hello. Great. Great. And Chris and Katie there.
Yes. Yeah. Hi, Bill. Yeah.
Hi, Chris. Two questions for you. How can you and your successor help us all think beyond electricity, avoiding the confusion between power, electricity, and energy, and to think beyond the local internal energy economies of our communities, Juneau, for example, to the worldwide global impact that we have? And second, how can KD be tracking the prospects for deep hot dry rock geothermal, which is ubiquitous on Earth and may be able to transcend wind and solar and our preoccupation with electricity and provide all of our energy? Thank you. And
Bill, I'll start with the deep hot rock geothermal. This is Katie's first morning, so we haven't briefed on that yet. But it is definitely a very intriguing and exciting technology because it does give us the possibility of potentially developing geothermal almost anywhere on the planet. So I know that that's something she's going to learn about. And
I'm familiar. I mean, I'm familiar to the extent. I'm certainly not a practitioner, but I am familiar with sort of this geothermal 2.0 or next gen geothermal. And
right.
I think that it is definitely, it's something that is being heavily invested in worldwide. I think that going back again to AI and server farm power needs, I think that the idea there are a lot of folks who have a lot of energy and thinking around, 10, 15 years from now, that will be kind of, the primary thing that provides good, affordable, firm power, has a relatively small footprint. There are some sort of questions around safety. There are it certainly is not cheap to develop, but I think it has a lot of potential. But kind of maybe hearkening back to something that Natalie said, REAP, like ACPRG, is really primarily focused on proven commercially available technologies that we can use and implement now to the benefit of Alaskans.
Mm-hmm. Well, to your first question too, Bill, I think we've already been here in Alaska seen around the world, particularly in places that have remote communities, as a place that's done very well in integrating renewables and microgrids. And I think that is still a niche for us that we can continue to work on and help people around the world. There's 800 million people on the planet who are relying on diesel. There's about another 800 million people who have no electricity at all. Many of those people live in communities like we have here in Alaska. So there is a huge opportunity for Alaska to continue to lead in that area.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bill. Let's stay with the phones for a moment and go to Rich in Glacier View. Hello.
Hey, folks. It's your good buddy Rich Stromberg calling from up the mountain. Hope you're doing well.
Hey, Rich.
My question is around if we look at one of our strengths is we have a lot of installed base already of renewables. So I'm wondering with losing a lot of these tax credits, incentives to build new systems, what opportunities might there be for us to focus funding and people on operations and maintenance, better remote monitoring to get the most out of our systems that we've already paid for?
Well, Bill, that's a lot of what REAP's been doing over the last several years is building up capacity and training for people who can monitor their projects, can understand what's going well and how they can optimize their projects. I think we're also going to have to really pivot a lot more toward energy efficiency. There's a difference between price and cost. If your prices go up, but you reduce your intake of energy by half, well, then you can still potentially stay ahead. And there's a lot of inefficient buildings here in the state. There's a lot of inefficiency even in some of our diesel generators that we still need to work on. So there's still lots of places where we can squeeze out some cost savings for people.
I think I would maybe just add to that that, you know, there's been a lot of change and a lot of uncertainty over the last handful of months. And, you know, this H.R. 1 bill just got passed a few days ago. I think one of the things that REAP and other organizations really need to do right now is sort of pause, do analysis, take stock, and really work with communities and collaborate with our partners and stakeholders and to try and, you know, work together to come up with, you know, what is the next best plan forward? Because I think right now there's just too many kind of unknowns. We haven't had time to fully digest and do that work.
Certainly, yeah. I did want to, some of what's listed for rescission in H.R. 1, the bill that the president signed on the 4th of July, there's a line that says, Chapter 5, Ending Green New Deal Spending, Promoting America First Energy and Other Reforms. First, ending Green New Deal spending. There isn't a Green New Deal, correct? There did some elements of that. That was a proposed resolution in the House. It never was enacted into an actual deal. But did some of it make pieces of that make it into other legislation? Or where is that language coming from?
I have no idea.
Who knows? I'd say some of the like notions and like ideas in the Green New Deal are using renewable energy. So I think it's just been used as a term to be able to question renewable energy programming and funding, which is, as we've been articulating thoroughly, is really what's the local energy resource question, which is, I know funding recipients really want it to be clear to this administration, and some of the coverage of the secretaries and Administrator Zeldin's visit to Alaska is that these projects actually align the projects that we're trying to implement with energy independence, unleashing our local energy dominance. And so there's nothing political in practice of the projects that people are trying to build in Alaska.
The idea of promoting America First Energy, does it seem with this legislation that this administration wants to aim that primarily at oil and gas? Shouldn't renewable energy development be considered America First also?
Oil and gas has had subsidies for a long, long time. Coal started getting subsidies with the building of the railroads in the 1800s. So renewables should be on a level playing field with other sources of energy. And the nice thing about renewables is they're inexhaustible. So once we understand how to harness those resources efficiently, they're there forever. And we've done that with a lot of these technologies. The cost of solar has come down 99% in the last 40 years. And so we need to continue to make those industries an important part of our industrial policy, which we really don't have in the United States, and a lot of other places around the world do. So to remain competitive, I think we have to do the all of the above approach.
Senator Murkowski said she tried to change elements of the bill before voting for it. Did she get some wins? Were you able to see some wins for energy in her requests? Natalie, I see you nodding.
Absolutely. Senator Murkowski was working on the day the Senate passed legislation to change the terminology in the bill for the energy tax credits from placed in service, which means you need to be completed with construction a year from today, to that 5% commissioned construction so that you've broken ground. And so had Senator Murkowski not been successful working with other senators and other similar demographic states, that language wouldn't be construction. It would be placed in service. So projects would need to be done a year from now.
President Trump wants to eliminate clean energy tax credits to pay for his other priorities. Do you worry that slowing down the push toward renewables puts the U.S. behind other nations in both addressing climate change, but also technical expertise for actually building these systems in the future?
Yeah, we're just going to be buying it from other people.
Yeah. There was actually a great article in The Atlantic just yesterday that was sort of talking about how essentially, a lot of what this does is sort of hand over, you know, the remaining production of wind and solar manufacturing to China, and really sort of like allow them to lock down those industries and have that kind of like dominant position on the world market. I think it does tremendous damage to right. to the industry in the United States.
There's been great coverage of how many new manufacturing projects and programs that's been popping up all over the United States, not a particular one in Alaska, but nationwide, and as a result of this funding and workforce development opportunities, the U.S. was starting to build a much larger manufacturing industry for this type of energy and just even materials and infrastructure. And now there's a level of uncertainty, and absolutely I saw that coverage as well, that it just puts other nations at the forefront and leaders. And microgrid communities, what places like AVEC are doing, they're the leaders in the nation of how to develop microgrid technology and integrate renewables in these types of communities that you then scale to bigger places. So right. We are a national asset and a leader, and that message has been brought repeatedly to DC, and it's just there's some misconnection that it's not translating into some full speed support for these projects.
The same thing's happening with automobiles. We had an electric car industry that was really starting to get off the ground, and now it's just going to go back to other countries like China. And BYD is now approaching Tesla in terms of the amount of cars they're selling and certainly in their affordability.
Bill, does AVEC work with the Denali Commission on projects, and is it known yet how their funding may be affected by what's happening currently?
I don't have a lens into what their funding looks like going into the future, but yes, we do work quite closely with Denali Commission and have, you know, prior to the Renewable Energy Fund in Alaska, Denali Commission was really a primary source of channeling federal funding into renewable projects throughout Alaska. I'm hopeful that that will continue, but I'm not sure what their coffers look like going forward.
So there's a lot that's unknown here. We're wrapping up, but what would you say the main, like, three main takeaways that you want folks to understand as you're learning more about this massive legislation and how it will affect projects in the future? The main points are that people can still get projects started this year, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and owner members of the co-ops in the Rail Belt should be talking to their board members about getting a project going in the time we have left.
And I'd say a lot of these projects aren't new. People have been looking for the opportunity to implement them, and we've been innovative and problem solving for decades, and so this is a setback, but it's not the end of the road.
Right.
All right, that's a positive note to end on. And Katie?
I think maybe just recognizing that none of this should be political. Government and has been investing in industry to get it going and investing in power systems for as long as they have existed. The Hoover Dam and Bonneville Power Authority, just to name a couple big ones in the lower 48. So.
All right. Well, thank you so much to my guests, Chris Rose, outgoing founder and executive director of REAP, Katie Lister, incoming executive director for LEAP. For REAP, Bill Stamm, who's on the line and the CEO of AVEC, and Natalie Kylie Bergen, energy lead for ACPERG. Thanks so much to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.